This is a People First Radio podcast.
What are the emotional impacts of witnessing and responding to overdose and overdose-related death continuously as part of your job? A new study says it's a subject that has been largely overlooked. That study explored the experiences of a group of harm reduction workers in Toronto. One finding was that conventional workplace supports like benefits weren't always available to people because they were in part-time roles. It also found that in some cases, when harm reduction workers were able to reach out to supports like employee assistance programs, they felt they were met with a lack of understanding about the realities of their job, and that left them feeling disconnected and discouraged. To learn more, I got in touch with the study's lead author.
My name is Jillian Cola. I'm an assistant professor at Memorial University in the Faculty of Medicine. I'm a public health researcher, and I've been doing a lot of research over the last few years in both BC and Ontario on a range of different solutions and interventions to address the North American drug toxicity crisis that we're currently in, and that's currently leading to a very devastating loss of lives across the country. And part of my interest in that is from my own background as a frontline service provider. And so I came to academia late after first working as a counselor and social worker with folks on the ground for quite a few years. And so that partly informs kind of like some of my research approaches and some of the questions that I like to look into in my research.
And on that front, one of your most recently released pieces of research was a study looking at the emotional impacts of overdose on harm reduction workers. That's what we're going to be talking about today. And before we get into it, maybe I think it would make sense to define what do we mean when we say harm reduction worker? What does that job look like on the day to day?
Yeah, that's a really great question because it can mean a whole bunch of different things. So generally in our paper and in our research, we're using that term to talk about a whole range of different people who work in the direct frontline provision of harm reduction services. So sometimes it's nurses, sometimes it's social workers and counselors, but we also include here people with lived experience or living experience of drug use, which are sometimes referred to as peer workers. And we made a decision as a study team, and our research team was a community-based research team with a lot of people who are people who use drugs or who are harm reduction workers themselves. And there was a strong feeling among our team members that we needed to call people workers and staff members, and not just peer workers, because we wanted to really focus on the fact that the work that they were doing was work, whether they came from a background that included lived experience of drug use or whether it was more of a professional background, and that both of those backgrounds brought expertise to their roles. It's also acknowledging the fact that in some of our organizations, peer positions are devalued. They're often not paid the same. They're not often having the same employment standards. So we see sometimes this kind of like two-tiered level of work within the field of harm reduction, which I think really reflects some of our structural biases and stigmas against people who use drugs. And so we were trying to make a deliberate move here to include all the different forms of work that people were doing in harm reduction as part of our definition of harm reduction workers.
And can you tell me, you mentioned, you know, you want to include that the work they're doing is work. What does that work look like? What are the tasks involved?
Yeah, no. So for our study, we talked to people, staff members and workers who were working in harm reduction programs, mainly within community agencies in the Toronto area. And all of these community agencies or community health centers had on-site supervised injection sites. And so these were workers who were generally spending a lot of time responding to overdoses and supporting people who use drugs within, you know, formal supervised injection services, but also folks who were working within organizations in broader harm reduction roles. So some people, for example, doing outreach within community settings, others who were doing kind of like more standard needle and syringe distribution type things within harm reduction programs. So it was that whole range of workers working in frontline community-based harm reduction.
And what were some of the main takeaways you found about what the emotional impact of all this is on the workers?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that unfortunately, one of the main messages from this study is that while people really, really find doing harm reduction work and doing service provision for people who use drugs to be valuable and rewarding work, it has been emotionally devastating as the drug toxicity crisis has come in Canada, and as it's gotten worse. And so in the context of Toronto, we saw fentanyl take over the drug market in starting around the beginning of 2017. And so there was this really, really big increase in the number of overdoses that workers were facing. That was part of the reason why we wanted to do this study is that working with a lot of frontline workers, people were telling us just about how difficult it was to be spending their days doing resuscitations on folks who they, you know, were spending the rest of their time hanging out with and chatting with and trying to connect to health services and social services and trying to provide them with supports in the communities, in their communities. And so it's it can be very, very emotionally difficult work. Two other things were really playing into this. The first is that you know, most of the overdoses that happen in private spaces, in people's own homes, when nobody's there to respond. So people talked about the tremendous toll in our communities that the overdose crisis is taking. Just how many of our friends, our family, our community members have been lost to the drug toxicity crisis. And how that just made the work so much more difficult coping with that grief and loss. The other thing that people talked about a lot was how difficult it was to do this work in the face of what felt like an abandonment from political public health leaders, having to fight for every single little bit of services they could get, and it never, ever being enough to support the number and the need that they were seeing in community. And that just made it feel like, you know, they were able to touch this tip of the iceberg, but that there was so much more work to be done that was really being ignored.
You mentioned that you'd been kind of hearing from people who worked in this space that, you know, this was really hard work, that it was emotionally impactful. What were you hoping to maybe learn from the study, given that, you know, there's a certain element of we know this is happening and it logically makes sense that responding to overdose and interacting with death regularly is going to be a difficult thing?
That's a really, really good question. So I think it was twofold. The one thing is that even though we all do know that this is happening, there's a lot of media attention on it, we're not often actually listening to the people who are doing the frontline work. They're telling us, and they have been telling us very clearly for quite a long time, what is needed, that people need good quality, affordable housing, that people need more services, that services need to be better funded to deal with the range of needs that they're seeing, that we need easily accessible mental health supports. People have been crying these things from the rooftops, but our political leaders haven't been listening. There's a real reticence to scale up the public health response and funding for a public health response to the drug toxicity crisis. And people were telling us so much about how difficult it was to continue doing work in that environment. And that even more than having to respond to overdoses and grieve the losses in community, it was that feeling of not being able to get people to care who were in positions of power that was the most difficult thing. The other thing is, and more concretely to your question, because these folks are workers, they're staff members in organizations, and they're being put through a certain amount of trauma within their staff role, there is a role for organizations to be able to support their workers, to be able to do this work in the best way possible. So one of our key questions was basically, how can we support and care for workers who are doing this difficult work? And so we asked them what was working and what wasn't working, and got some ideas for kind of the supports that they wanted, so that concretely we have some ideas from the people who are living through this, what the supports that they would like and that would be helpful for them might be.
Which leads to the natural next question of what were those supports?
Yeah. So, I mean, getting back to kind of like more kind of like organizational level, a lot of folks, because they were in temporary or part-time positions, didn't have access to benefits. They didn't have access to vacation or sick days. And so really just making sure that people have access to these type of fairly basic supports, so benefits, so they can access counseling and massages and things like that, as well as, you know, making sure that people have access to vacation and sick days so that they can take the time that they need, like leaves to deal with grief, or when they come across a very, very difficult situation at work was also mentioned as being helpful. Some other things that are also necessary is kind of beyond the kind of like, you know, traditional benefit structure. We heard from a lot of people that this move towards, even from full-time workers who had access to things like employee assistance programs, where you can call in, there's a central number, you can call in to talk to a counselor who's going to help you and support you with issues that you've encountered at work. A lot of times when people actually tried to avail themselves of those services, they found themselves supporting the employee assistance counselor person because they had no skills to deal with the situations they were facing on the front lines on a regular basis. And so what we really need to see is specialized supports that really are aware of the crisis of overdose deaths that's happening and that are really well adapted to the type of continuing trauma that workers are facing. And I think here, one thing that we came across, one idea we came across when we were doing this work was the idea that most of our trauma-based supports are based on the idea that the trauma happened and now you're going to help a person to kind of consolidate that experience, cope with it, and move forward in their life. But what does it look like to help somebody where the trauma is continuing? Because the trauma that people are facing from the level of deaths from the overdose crisis is unfortunately continuing. This isn't something where right now we're seeing an end in sight. And workers who are doing this work are really, really saying, wow, how am I going to cope with having to deal with this many losses on a regular basis? And we actually don't have really good models for that type of work. And so that's really a big need going forward, is figuring out how to really help people deal with this continuing trauma that comes from the continuation of the overdose crisis. And this is where really we actually need to get ahead of the problem. We need to deal with the fact that people are overdosing rather than keep on putting solutions in place to try to help support people or after the overdoses occur. So kind of like going a little bit upstream and dealing with some of those upstream solutions.
You're listening to People First Radio. The emotional impact of witnessing and responding to overdose and overdose-related deaths have been largely overlooked, according to a new study in the International Journal of Drug Policy. That study looked at the experiences of harm reduction workers in Toronto. I'm speaking with its lead author, Jillian Cola of Memorial University. Certainly, that was one of the big themes I took from reading through this study, this idea that even when there are programs in place, you know, it seemed like based on some of the testimonials that it was almost like reaching out to the employee assistance programs did more harm than good for people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when people have to spend a lot of time just describing the day-to-day reality. And also, I mean, we have to grapple with the fact that drug use is incredibly stigmatized. And so even people who are providing services to people who use drugs, that care is often very, very stigmatized. And so they would often, people who were talking about having called into employee assistance programs would talk about how they had to spend a huge amount of time doing just basic education on harm reduction and the overdose crisis and the toll of deaths, and that no, people weren't responsible for their deaths because they made a choice to use a drug that they didn't know what potency or what it was composed of, that was just, you know, an unregulated drug market and a condition of it. And so it was really one of those cases where people had to actually do their own work when they were calling in for support, trying to educate the people who were supposed to be supporting them, and how very, very unhelpful that was. And again, that really, really talks about the need for kind of specialized supports for this group of workers that really reflect the situation that they find themselves in.
A quote I wanted to perhaps highlight from this study, given that we've entered the eighth year in British Columbia of this being declared a public health emergency this week, and that was that The slowness of everything makes me feel extremely mad, said one participant. What do you maybe reflect on from that?
Oof. I mean, that's one of the main messages that people were trying to tell us, right? Is that they feel like now, I mean, you're talking about how it's almost a decade in British Columbia that we're dealing with this tremendous crisis of overdose-related deaths. People within the harm reduction sector have been trying to raise attention to the need for a comprehensive, wide-ranging, systematic crisis response. Even in BC, which is the one province that has declared a state of emergency, we've never seen an emergency response that responds to the actual scale of the crisis. And here, I think that comparisons to the COVID pandemic are sometimes a little bit overdone, but I think it is just interesting to note that when we did face a major public health emergency like COVID, we were able to really mobilize huge amounts of resources within the healthcare system, social services, and across society as a whole to try to address that issue and protect people's health in a way that we have never done in the overdose crisis. And I think that really at this point, it almost feels like there's a lot of lip service being paid to the crisis without a lot of actual action. And that is really, really, and people told us this over and over again in this study, that's really been damaging. And that's really, really been hard for people because we know what we can do to actually start to address this crisis. It started because we had a massive shift in the drug supply. And so we have to get back to interventions that really do try to address that. And I think that the slowness that people are talking about are the issues with, wow, we've been at this now for almost a decade. And we've been talking about what needs to happen for almost a decade. And it's still not happening. And that's just absolutely soul destroying.
Talking about a study that is really about people's very intense emotional responses to a horrendous situation, I think it's always going to be hard to maybe capture exactly what that feels like. But maybe to help do that, I've picked out a couple of quotations that I'm gonna read through. So it's traumatizing, and then there's nothing for workers to deal with that trauma. You just have to go back to work. We have no idea what the impact of all of this is going to be like on us, and I just do not want to live my life feeling the way I feel right now. Another one, who is going to want to have a relationship with me when I'm always so sad and I'm always just talking about death all the time? I don't know, is there anything you can say to really convey, like, again, off the top we were talking about, yeah, we hear this is going on and we understand that working in overdose response is going to involve maybe sometimes people die in your work, and everyone can understand kind of implicitly, yeah, that is hard. But is there anything you can say just about what this is like talking to actual people, what it is like for them on the ground?
I mean, I think here it might just be best if I talk about my own experience. And for a long time, I had on my wall a place where it was pictures and, you know, those little handouts they give, those missalettes that they give at a person's funeral. I really, really wanted to remember the people in our community, in my friends, among my friends, in my family, who had died from overdoses, and not forget them. And it got to the point where there was no space left on the wall because I had lost personally so many people. And this really hit home to me when I was in a meeting just a couple weeks ago with another frontline worker. And she actually told something very, very similar, that she had for the longest time kept, you know, pictures, memorials of the people that she had lost and on her wall, and that eventually she ran out of room. And while she had started it because she wanted to not forget the ones that we have loved and the ones that we've lost, it just actually became so overwhelmingly sad. to have that reminder all the time of how much we were failing as a society to address this crisis. And so I think that if you had asked me 10 years ago if we would have ever seen the scale of death that we have seen from the overdose crisis, there was no way I would have been able to describe it. And in fact, I think the biggest issue right now, as we kind of like move into close to a decade of this crisis, is we're normalizing absolutely huge and high levels of deaths. And it didn't used to be this way. I remember being in a meeting in 2018, around the time that we started this study, and we had just doubled the number of people in Ontario who had died of overdose that year. It went from around 750 to close to 1,500 in a year. And I remember saying in the meeting, we can't normalize this. We can't let this scale of death become our new normal. Just a couple of years ago, it was 300 people a year in Ontario. We normalized 750. Now we're normalizing 1,500. And you know what? In the time since then in Ontario, now we're between 2,500 and 3,000 people dying of overdose every year. It doesn't have to be this way. These are preventable deaths. And rather than coming out full force to try to address them, we're, you know, arguing over politicizing issues that should just be really, really straightforward, common sense approaches. And I think the thing that is for me the most difficult in dealing with this is just knowing how many more people we're going to lose that we don't have to, because of this continuing stigma, discrimination, and reticence to just deal with, you know, substance use as a very, very straightforward, common sense issue, rather than the incredibly politicized football that it's become.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Jillian Cola, an assistant professor at Memorial University in the Faculty of Medicine. We're speaking about a study into the emotional impacts of overdose on harm reduction workers. Reading through this study on that front, you almost get a sense of there are two realities almost. There's one for the people who are in this world and experiencing this, and then there's another that manifests itself, whether that's in the form of, say, counselors on the other end of a phone at an employee assistance program who haven't really been through this, or, for example, here's another quotation, "I spend my weekend in the thick of the grief with no work support and with a family that's saying, well, it's just your client." So, I don't know, do you have any reflections on that idea of how to cross that divide of people who maybe aren't immersed in this world, and this idea of like, this is your work, this is a consequence of that, you've just got to deal with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, really valid question. So some of my other research has actually looked at the idea of care and what role care has in harm reduction work and how we conceptualize drug use and responses to substance use. And I think at the crux of that question is this impulse within harm reduction to really try to provide care and support to folks who haven't been able to find it in other aspects of our public health and social service system. And so within healthcare, there's often this idea that you keep people at arm's length because you have to do that to be able to keep going. You know, you don't personalize things too much. You don't personalize relationships too much. And harm reduction, I think, has really embraced in many ways ideas of care and community and coming together to support each other, because for the longest time, there was no broader supports within public health. You know, people who use drugs had to care for each other and had to do things themselves because no one was coming to save them. No one was coming to rescue them. No one was coming to help them because drug use was so stigmatized and is still so stigmatized. And so it's really this conflict, I think, that people are feeling about how, wow, I really do need to care about people to do this work well. But then that means that I'm opening myself up to this huge loss if and when somebody passes away. And I think that is something that I'm not sure how to grapple with. I don't think that there's an easy answer there, because, you know, caring for people is important And keeping care as a main part of this work is important. And we can't lose that amidst everything else that we've lost.
What then are you hoping maybe comes out of the work that you've done as a next step?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that really concretely, there was some suggestions in our paper for supports for workers. So for example, making sure that everybody has access to benefits, everybody has access to vacation and leave when they need it. Also, there's been some really, really good work in some areas of the country in terms of making sure that there are grief and bereavement supports for people working on the front lines of the overdose crisis. I think that needs to be scaled up and made sure that everybody has access to specialized supports that really are adapted to the realities of this crisis. And there's been some movement, even in the time since we've done this research, on that front, making sure that it's community-based and very, very responsive to people's needs. So that's a positive, and that can be expanded. But I think more broadly, it's this tension between, sure, we can, you know, help and support individual workers, but again, we have to get ahead of this crisis. And that means really, really addressing the fact that this is, at its forefront, a drug policy crisis, a drug supply crisis. We need to actually be looking at these major structural factors, like how criminalization of drug use has made it much more difficult to get people the care and support that they need, and how we need to really be looking into regulation and having people have access to a regular known dose of a substance. If they're going to be choosing to use anyway, the volatility in the current supply is what is killing people. And so we need those larger structural solutions to basically stop this crisis, so grief and loss in the first place.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today?
No, but I appreciate having this conversation. So thank you for having me.
Jillian, thank you so much for making the time and being here today, virtually. Jillian Kola is an assistant professor at Memorial University in the Faculty of Medicine. We were talking about a study examining the emotional impacts of overdose and overdose-related death on harm reduction workers.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.